if Tucker is really this disgusted by Christian Zionists, by which he means the Mike Huckabees and Ted Cruz's of the world, by which he also means probably a plurality of the Republican Party's voting base. I mean, maybe not an outright statistical majority, but definitely a plurality. Then he really has in his crosshairs a much larger percent of the American population than just the tiny sliver that are American Jews. He really hates a lot of Christians. He really hates a lot of evangelicals. He really hates a lot of sincere Christians, dare I say Christians who are a lot more sincere than he is, who interpret the scripture in a way that does not redound to Tucker Carlson's liking there. So I think that we have to kind of frame this more broadly. It's not just a war on the Jews, which it definitely is to an extent. It's also a war on evangelical Protestantism. It's a war on the Bible. It's a war on the ecumenical biblical inheritance that birthed Western civilization.
Welcome to the Misagav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what is happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host, a Misagav Institute Senior Fellow and Senior Political Correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Frebin, Misagav Institute Executive Director, a Visiting Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and your co-host. The Misagav Institute is Israel's leading national security policy center dedicated to strengthening Israel's security, its regional cooperation, and its international alliances. Each week here on Mideast Horizons, we bring you fresh insights, not only on the most critical developments in Israel and the Middle East, but also key updates on the most important trends and opportunities taking shape in this incredible region.
Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to your podcast to keep up to date and ahead of the curve on everything happening in the Middle East. You can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
And we read and respond to your comments, so please keep sending them. And we've received some great suggestions to date. This week, we have on the show Josh Hammer, senior editor-at-large at Newsweek and one of the most prominent commentators on American politics and the U.S.-Israel relationship. We have a fascinating conversation that goes in-depth into the debate that's happening in the United States on the America right and the future of the U.S.-Israel relationship and really the battle for Western civilization. But before we get to Josh, Lav, you published, I think yesterday, a very interesting piece in Jewish Insider about the comments of one of Qatar's most prominent faces, one of the people who's sort of been leading the image of Qatar over the last 2 years. Do you want to tell us about that?
So hello, everyone from the U.S. I'm talking to you from a hotel room. For those who are watching in video, it's not the usual setup. I published an article about Majid al-Ansari, who really is one of the prominent sort of faces and voices of Qatar. He is an advisor to the prime minister on foreign policy, and he's the spokesman of the foreign ministry of Qatar, which means that he does their press conferences that they do somewhat regularly. And before he had those jobs, but when he was still working in public positions in Qatar, he praised Palestinian suicide bombers. He had very positive things to say about Palestinian Islamic Jihad shooting over 100 rockets in Israel. And then this was in 2021. They ended up shooting thousands of rockets in Israel. And he celebrated it on social media, in a blog that he wrote. And then when I asked the Qatari embassy in the U.S. for a response, he started deleting his blog posts. But I think that this is indicative of the Qatari sort of position. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that that would be someone's position, right, if the spokesman said something a few years before. But we all know that Qatar funds the Muslim Brotherhood and funds Hamas. So it shouldn't come as a great surprise that someone who's funding Hamas supports suicide bombings, which was once a trademark of Hamas's, and shooting rockets in Israel, which they would be doing right now if there weren't IDF soldiers around to try to stop them.
But I think it shows the support for Hamas even deeper. It's not just, you know, financial support or political support, but it's really ideological support. If I was looking at one of the tweets, and it Eitan Fishberger, who's the one who surfaced some of these tweets and some of these blog posts. So Majid Ansari writes, "Jerusalem, the interior, the West Bank, and Gaza, decades and successive projects to dismantle and isolate them collapse, only for them all to rise with one voice against the occupier."
Right, which should be clear. This was in 2021, Operation Guardians of the Walls. It wasn't just rockets shot from Gaza into Israel, like most of these, you know, mini wars with Gaza were. In this case, there were Israeli Arabs in mixed cities who were rioting and burning down synagogues and Jewish owned businesses.
The interior is a euphemism for what people would call
sovereign Israel.
Yeah, sovereign Israel within the Green Line, 1948 Israel, pre-1967 Israel. And what he's celebrating is the fact that there's this rising up of the Arab citizens of Israel to attack Israel. And when he talks about successive projects to dismantle and isolate them collapse, he's referring to the attempts to establish a two-state solution, right? So then you have the Palestinian Authority and you have the State of Israel, and these, you know, you, in a sense, is isolated too because it's two separate political entities. And he's celebrating the fact that this idea is collapsing and the Palestinian people as one are rising up to dismantle or to attack Israel. And when the Qataris are talking to President Trump or Special Envoy Witkoff, or in general, when they're talking to Israeli journalists as well, who they've hosted, they talk about
specifically, right? This man, Al-Ansari, is the one who was doing the interviews.
Right, exactly. He's talking about how, you know, we just, the Palestinian people just need just need their freedom. We just need a Palestinian state. We just want there to be peace between Israel and the Palestinians. And, you know, I guess it's conceivable that he's changed his mind over the last several years. But at least according to the statement, he's celebrating the fact that the idea of two states is, you know, collapsing because the people, the Palestinian people as one in Israel and in the Palestinian Authority, are rising up to overthrow Israel. So it's not just, you know, supporting Hamas on a technical level, but it's supporting Hamas's goal also of wiping Israel off the map.
Yeah, and we'll get into this a little bit later with our guest Josh Hammer, but it is disturbing that the Trump administration and the Biden administration before them, but we're dealing with the Trump administration now, really doesn't recognize the depths of the support for terrorism that's coming out of Doha, and that they treat them as honest brokers.
Now, what we're seeing, I think, in Gaza is we have the IDF, as people know, about half of Gaza, 50% of Gaza. The other half is now being controlled effectively by Hamas. And the idea of the Trump police pen that was put together by Special Envoy Witkoff and by others was this, the very first point in the 20-point plan is Gaza will be a de-radicalized, terror-free zone that does not pose a threat to its neighbor. That's point number one, the 20-point plan. In practice, what we're seeing is Hamas has reasserted its control over not just 50% of the territory, but 80% of the population. And the idea that people are sort of holding on to is that you'll set up this international stabilization force made up of Arab and Muslim troops, and they'll be the ones bringing about the disarmament of Hamas. And in this context, King Abdullah, the King of Jordan, had a very interesting comment in an interview I gave, I believe, to the BBC, where he said, what is the mandate of security forces inside of Gaza? We hope that it's peacekeeping. Because if it's peace enforcing, nobody will want to touch that. And then he explains, what does that actually mean? Peacekeeping is when you're sitting there and supporting the local police force, which are willing to train local Palestinian police officers. But that's going to take time, as he says. But if we're running around Gaza on patrol with weapons, that's not a situation that any country would want to get involved in. And, you know, once things are going from paper to practical on the ground, I think we're going to find that more and more Arab and Muslim countries, I think that, as we've said on this podcast, you and I, a number of times, they're not interested in doing the dangerous and difficult work, and I frankly don't blame them, of actually trying to take Hamas's weapons away from them. They have this idea that over time, maybe they'll train Palestinian police officers, and maybe those police officers will be able to somehow either integrate Hamas into those forces or take away their weapons or take away their Hamas weapons, give them police force weapons. But this idea that our forces are going to disarm Hamas, I think, is becoming clear that is unfortunately not going to happen.
I mean, I think we need to back up. Or not even back up, it's really fast forward because the King of Jordan made those statements a few days ago, and talk about what's happening as we speak. As we're recording this podcast on Tuesday, October 28th, the ceasefire looks like it's breaking down. You know, it might be brought back on track. Ceasefires can often have like stops and spurts. But remember that, you know, we're more than 2 weeks into the ceasefire and Hamas is still holding the bodies of 13 hostages. On Monday, they returned what they said were the remains of another hostage, and it was partial remains of a hostage whose body was mostly recovered in October 2023. And not only that, but Hamas tried to fake that they had like discovered these remains underground. So an IDF drone captured, you know, videotaped as a Hamas terrorist took the remains, I think, out of a hospital. I don't remember if it was out of the hospital or tunnel or what. They took it outside, they put it in a hole in the ground, and they covered it with some dirt so that they could then film themselves taking it out from under the ground for their propaganda to claim, look, we uncovered this hostage's body. So they knew exactly where this body was all the time and then lied about it, which the Israeli intelligence thinks is the case with almost all of the bodies that it still hasn't returned. That it wasn't even one of the 13 that Israel counts as one of the 13. So it's violating in that way. And then it's violating the ceasefire in the way that they shot at IDF soldiers today on Tuesday. And I want to read you something that a friend of mine sent. He asked me not to say his name, but it's a friend of mine who is in Gaza right now. And he said, I'm on the yellow line and Hamas tests us every freaking day in addition to numerous ceasefire violations. They shot at us a bunch of times that don't make the news. They tried to pin down our sniper team last week and we had to pull them out with tanks. From my experience, the ceasefire really just means we're not using the air force before. And then later he says, we're working harder now than before the ceasefire. Before the ceasefire, the air force would obliterate anyone who poked their head above the ground. So it's, I mean, this... Thank God we have all the hostages back. Okay, that's what we got out of the ceasefire. But it's not a ceasefire. And that needs to be taken care of. And I believe...
But I just want to put it right, because it's really important, I think, what you're saying. What we're hearing from the forces on the ground is that beyond what reaches the news, there are numerous attempts by Hamas to break the ceasefire, to attack the IDF troops. And because of this desire not to, you know, sort of... disrupt the ceasefire to give it a chance, Israel is not using its air force, and that's putting its ground troops in greater danger.
Correct. And I mean, I think that that's an absurd situation. Now, last week when Vice President J.D. Vance was in Israel, he said that everybody has to sort of be patient, you know, and the ceasefire is not going to come into place in a day. And I think he was right about that. I think that's fine and that's a fair thing to say, but we can't just be twiddling our thumbs while Hamas reestablishes itself and while Hamas tries to kill our soldiers, right? Like, if the expectation is that Israel's going to sit on its hands until the U.S. figures out, fleshes out the details of Trump's plan, like, that's not a realistic expectation. And so, you know, as a result of all the things we just talked about, Israel started airstrikes again on Tuesday. It might be by the time this podcast comes out, the U.S. will get angry and it'll stop like it did last time. But my understanding is that Israel is, at the very least, gave Washington a heads up. But this sort of all supports my belief from the moment that this plan was announced, which is that nobody's, and you know, we both agreed on this, we both said this at the time, nobody's going to disarm Hamas except for Israel. The war is not over until Hamas is disarmed.
And I think where we might be heading is, you know, there's also pressure, and in fact, it's actually even in clause number 17, which I think we talked about, this idea that in areas that Israel controls, that in those areas, reconstruction can begin. And I've always said that in places where Hamas is not present, we may well have Israel's partners, moderate regional states like the UAE, like perhaps Saudi Arabia, getting involved. And what I think you might have is, you know, call it Eastern Gaza versus Western Gaza. In Eastern Gaza, you might have this cooperation between sort of an Abraham Accords alliance of Israel, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, not necessarily a formal alliance, but a de facto alliance, rebuilding part of Eastern Gaza. And then Western Gaza, you have this Muslim Brotherhood axis where you have Hamas, you have attempts by Qatar and by Turkey to continue to support them, to sort of also present their narrative to the West, and you know, sort of helping them make excuses for what they're doing or they're not doing. And Gaza may become a local center of a much broader Middle Eastern conflict. Certainly, that's not the way the administration sees it, but I think that may be where we are heading.
I hope that Gaza doesn't become the center of a broader Middle East conflict. That doesn't sound good. And I also think that the Arab partners don't want that to happen, right? Like, I think that that's why the King of Jordan said what he said, and I think everyone else kind of feels that way. But I think this idea of an East Gaza and a West Gaza, it's certainly become popular. I think our last two guests talked about it, right? The idea that people will move to the Israel-controlled part of Gaza because it's being rebuilt assumes a level of freedom that I don't think most Gazans have because they're living in the Hamas-controlled Gaza, right? And we saw this during the war where Israel would create humanitarian safe zones and then Hamas would shoot people who were trying to go to the safe zones. It's not a bad idea in theory, but it needs to address that important issue.
And the other important thing to point out is that on the one hand, again, it's called East Gaza or Eastern Gaza, has the border with Israel. And insofar as there is, and frankly, with Egypt as well, because Israel remains in the perimeter zone in the south. So insofar as there are goods coming from the east, from other Arab states, they can come into Eastern Gaza and not reach Hamas. On the other hand, Hamas controls the coastline, which is critical from an economic perspective and from a development perspective. So that also, you know, whether the idea of the economic viability of Gaza in the future will be difficult when on the one hand, sort of one side has control of the hinterland or and also the borders with other states, whereas the other side, Hamas, has control of the coastline.
Well, a few kilometers, right? But it's Rafah, but also the northern Gaza, right? The Erez, I guess, area. That could be part of the plan if the idea is to develop, it wouldn't be like a huge port or it wouldn't be whatever, but like maybe to allow fishing in those areas, right? I don't know because I don't think that like Hamas is, they're not able to rebuild unless the materials get into their zones, you know? So I don't know how much of a difference that'll make.
With Josh, we're going to go deep into American politics and the debate that's happening on the American right and the future that and how that's impacting both the debate about America itself, but the future of U.S.-Israel politics. But before we get into that, Lav, we are now officially at most 1 year away from elections in Israel, perhaps less, perhaps significantly less. Can you give us a quick update on what's happening in terms of Israeli politics, elections, coalition? Where we are right now.
Somehow this coalition is surviving. It doesn't have a majority in the Knesset. It is attempting to pass a bill that will essentially continue the exemption for most Haredi men from the IDF. There'll be some penalties in 2 years, and God only knows what will happen politically in 2 years. So kicking the can down the road, which is what has been happening all along. But it hasn't happened yet. And the Haredim still are, you know, in many cases, not voting with the coalition. And eventually they're going to hit a real road bump, right? The coalition can just sort of like coast and not try to pass very important bills for a while. But they have to pass a budget. There's an initial end of year deadline, but the real deadline is March 1st. And if there's no budget by March 1st, then the Knesset is automatically dissolved and there's an election held in 90 days, 90 days after March 1st. So my feeling is the way things stand now, this government's not going to last past March 1st, but if Netanyahu manages to pass some sort of law that satisfies the Haredim, then they could survive longer.
My thinking was that after the release of the hostages and President Trump's really historic speech in the Knesset, that Netanyahu would want to go to elections as quickly as possible, also to try to avoid this big, you know, ugly public debate over the Haredi conscription or really non-conscription. Though I would say the common knowledge in Israel is that actually Netanyahu's goal is to, or the common knowledge, but the opinion of many political commentators in Israel is that Netanyahu is going to try to keep his government going for as long as possible and not enter the uncertainty of elections. Personally, I think that if he doesn't see the possibility of another peace agreement with Saudi Arabia or Indonesia in the near future, in the next few months, he will try to avoid a big fight or passage or non-passage of this Haredi conscription bill and will try to go to elections. Also, look, right now, the 20 hostages are out, and every day there's another news item about somebody, being, you know, one of them being released from the hospital, one of them going back home, one of them going to the beach, one of them going to a sports event, and it's deeply, deeply moving and joyous. And then also people are waiting for all the murder hostages to be returned and looking forward to that. We may well be in 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, the scenes that may be dominating from Gaza may be of Hamas's parades and rocket attacks being reestablished once again. And that's something I think that Netanyahu will want to avoid. And he can do that by going to, or he can try to do that by going to elections as quickly as possible. But of course, in Israeli politics, you never know.
The polls are improving for Netanyahu, but they haven't drastically improved. And I think he's still sort of in the danger zone as far as the polling is concerned, even though Likud always does better than what the polls say in advance. The other thing is Netanyahu, like in his disposition, like generally is very conservative. And I think he prefers, you know what they say, a bird in the hand over two in the bush. And I do think, you know, people are like, oh, Netanyahu, he just wants to stay in power as long as possible. Yes, I think that that is a trait of all politicians, basically, right? They have power, they want to keep it, like not as dictators, but, you know, like as much as they can by the law. So I don't think he's in a rush to an election. Maybe he could have tried to capitalize on the hostages coming home. But, you know, I saw a really interesting poll from the Israel Democracy Institute, which said, basically, they asked people, who do you give credit for the hostages coming home? And for President Trump, it was 95%. For the IDF, it was like 70-something percent. And the hostage families was like 60-something percent. And Netanyahu was 51%. So I think, you know, there's something a little absurd about that, right? Because like the IDF wouldn't act if the prime minister didn't tell it to act. But leaving that aside, I think that Netanyahu, the people who like him, or at least liked him at some point, right-leaning people, will give him credit. And the people who didn't like him anyway won't give him credit. So maybe he's looking at things like that. Maybe he has his own pulse that he's looking at and saying that he can't capitalize on it.
The one thing that we should also point out is that according to all the polling, it seems like a called center or a non-Netanyahu coalition, they would either, their options are basically this. They wouldn't have enough seats. Again, we don't know, it could be Eisenkot or Gantz or Bennett or Yoaz Hendel, all the various people who have sort of thrown their hats into the ring or are currently in the Knesset. But in order to establish coalition, they would either have to establish coalition with the Likud headed by Netanyahu, because nobody else is going to challenge Netanyahu for the head of the Likud, or with the right, with Bezalel Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, or with the Haredim, which would put them right back into this whole question of Haredi draft, because that would be the one issue that the Haredim would raise in coalition talks, or with the Arab parties, which is a complex issue, and maybe we should discuss it in a future podcast episode. But most of the parties have said that they aren't going to sit with the Arab parties, some of whom are anti-Zionist and pro-Muslim Brotherhood.
This is something that I know our Emirati friends, it drives them crazy, but isn't it funny how there's the anti-Zionist parties and then there's the Muslim Brotherhood party? That they're not necessarily anti, like, they probably are anti-Zionist, but they're willing to put that aside to work with us. So, anyway, it's a strange thing.
Funny thing I want to point out, it's kind of funny. So, there was a lot of talk in Israel about, sort of Israel's like, called Saturday Night Live. It's called Eretz Nedaret. It's a left-leaning satire show. And they had a skit about, basically the point of the skit was, BB is Trump's poodle, and whatever Trump says, BB does. And, you know, Trump's praise of BB in his speech was not really what he meant. He really just meant that BB does whatever I say. So in Israel, on the one hand, you had these protesters saying, you know, Trump wants a ceasefire, BB listens to Trump, and then laughing at BB or putting satire against BB for saying, oh, you listen, you know, you're a poodle, you listen to Trump. And then on the American sort of woke right, the Candaces and the Tuckers, people saying,
and the woke,
oh, Trump is
too.
Bad because Trump is BB's poodle. So there's a disagreement between the Israeli woke and the American woke, whether it's BB is Trump's poodle or Trump is BB's poodle. And obviously the reality is much more complicated.
Yeah, I mean, I think it all has to do with whether you believe in anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that Jews are controlling the world or not. which is a really good transition to our guest, Josh Hammer.
This week on Mideast Horizons, we're joined by Josh Hammer. Josh Hammer is senior editor at large at Newsweek and host of the Josh Hammer Show podcast. He's a syndicated columnist and frequent commentator on many leading platforms and outlets. He's also the senior counsel at the Article 3 Project and the Internet Accountability Project, a research fellow at the Edmund Burke Foundation, and a fellow with the Palm Beach Freedom Foundation. Josh is one of the leading voices advocating for a strong U.S.-Israel relationship and for a deep Christian-Jewish partnership for the future of Western civilization and values. So without further ado, please stay tuned for this wide-ranging conversation with Josh Hammer.
Josh, thank you so much for coming on the show. We brought you here, you have a new book out, which we'll discuss, but I also wanted to talk to you about the sort of rift in the American right over Israel, anti-Semitism. So I thought maybe we'd just dive in with the latest news on the day that we're talking, which is Tucker Carlson having known anti-Semite Nick Fuentes on his show, and then talking about how the thing he despises the most in the world are Christian Zionists, how it's evil and it's a corruption of the Bible. And I mean, he seems very, very obsessed with, in this case, he's talking about Christian Zionists, not Jews, but very, very obsessed with Israel. And that seems to be working for him as a strategy and getting a lot of attention for it. So how do you think that this has taken root as like somewhat a popular theme in the conservative media space or the right-wing media space?
Sure. So thanks for having me. There's a lot to unpack here, and I'm not sure that we're going to be able to unpack all the strands in just this one answer, but I guess just a few things that leap off the page. One is that I will start on a positive note, which is I typically like to encourage folks who are rightly alarmed by things like this to not overreact as well. So for instance, a lot of this fight, especially over the past month and a half since the tragic assassination of my friend Charlie Kirk, has been over the future direction of Turning Point USA. Well, I debated the libertarian so-called comedian Dave Smith at the Turning Point USA conference in July. And at that conference, Charlie and his team did a push poll of all 4,000 predominantly younger people in attendance. And for whatever it's worth, 73% of the attendees at that conference said that they were pro-Israel. We can debate what that means. We can also debate whether or not that 73% might have been 90% 10 years ago. Perhaps it would have been, but that's still a pretty healthy majority. And furthermore, 86% of the folks at that particular conference said that they supported President Trump's strikes on the Iranian nuclear facilities, because the conference was just a few weeks after that. So the first thing is for people not to overly freak out. There definitely are some very troubling voices. Few have been louder than I have been in calling them out, especially Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson. There's a few reasons why some folks might be doing this, right? There's the potential that there are simply clicks and that there are a lot of downloads when it comes to saying some of this stuff there. I had a recent conservative podcaster, someone who I'm friendly with, I will not reveal his name, but he said to me, Josh, he said, you know, when I have the word Israel in the title of one of my episodes, the algorithms are such that I get 5 times more clicks. Okay, and for what it's worth, my friend is actually pretty good on the question of the Jews. So this is not, he's not coming from this from a hostile place, but that's just one possibility. And for what it's worth, Charlie had speculated that to me as well, that he looked at some of these other folks, Steve Bannon as well, who are just trending in a generally negative direction when it comes to these topics. And there's always a possibility that it's just kind of clout chasing or click chasing.
That begs the question, though, why are there more clicks? Are there more clicks because there is this sort of animus towards Israel that's not coming out, or because it allows them to sound edgy and anti-establishment? I mean, what's driving the clicks? Because the Jews are the pro-Israel community is reacting very harshly, so therefore it drives this debate.
Right. Well, we don't actually know exactly how many of these clicks are organic versus foreign bot farmed, right? I mean, that's kind of another lurking question in the background here, is that there's really no transparency, no visibility when it comes to YouTube, when it comes to X. it's very hard, if not impossible, to tell just how much of it is organic coming from an American IP address, or whether it is coming from Russia or you know, Pakistani bot farms or whatever there. You know, this is actually one of the things that I think that Elon Musk has frankly failed at, is that he actually promised when he took over X that he would open up the algorithms, make it more transparent, and that he would actually get rid of the bots. Well, it seems to me that actually, for just being honest here, that Elon has not succeeded on either of those planks. But in any event, that's only part of the answer to your question. The part of the answer to your question that I think is more troubling is that, yeah, there definitely is, I think, at least something of a market for this. And there are a few reasons that come to mind for me as to why this may be the case. So I'll just kind of just rattle them off. One is that for a lot of younger Americans and younger American conservatives, folks under the age of 20, 25, folks who have little to no memory of 9/11, they grew up entirely in this milieu where America has been generally shielded from radical Islamist terror attacks. And they have also looked at what I think indeed are many of the failures of American foreign policy around the world when it comes to the prolonged nature of our engagements in things like Iraq and Afghanistan, the failed humanitarian intervention in Libya to topple Muammar Gaddafi. And there are a lot of folks who draw a very specious line. They draw this line nonetheless. It doesn't hold up ultimately, but they draw a line nonetheless between the various American foreign policy boondoggles in the broader Islamic world and the perception of Israeli influence on American foreign policy. Certainly when I've debated Dave Smith, which I've done twice this year, he loves bringing up this point. He loves bringing up this. He says, oh, Bibi Netanyahu testified in the U.S. Congress in the fall of 2002. He talked George W. Bush into Iraq. And they're leaving out a lot of details here. They're leaving out the fact that, among other things, Ariel Sharon literally opposed Bush going into Iraq. So they're leaving out a lot of the history. But this narrative, unfortunately, I think in some places, has really kind of taken off. In my opinion, the single number one biggest reason why not just anti-Israelism, but anti-Semitic conspiratorialism is ascendant. Again, not sound alarm, it's not a level 10 hurricane yet, but it's definitely growing. I think the number one reason why it is growing is because American society has gone to the point where Americans, by and large, I think in many times, kind of just the median American you'll find at the local gas station or supermarket, has just lost any and all ability to trust the narrative from the ruling class, from the elites. This is a longstanding problem here in the United States. I personally trace it back to the Russiagate controversy from 2016, that this notion that Donald Trump was a Russian agent. I personally, in my telling of history, I draw a straight line from that to the 2.5-year Mueller probe that disrupted the first Trump term, to the 2020 election and the COVID-19 lockdowns and the two-tier system between people who just wanted to go to church and synagogue versus the Black Lives Matter protesters, the Hunter Biden laptop in the 2020 election there, and then the Biden administration literally prosecuting their political opposition. There's been a lot of things, I think, that have caused the American people to kind of,
and the Biden administration covering up his, mental state, his aging. I mean, that's...
So absolutely. So there's been a lot of things that I think have caused the American people to lose, to an extent, their ability to tell right and wrong, their ability to tell fact from fiction, and so forth. And historically speaking, when society loses its ability to tell truth from distortions and fact from lies, and just generally loses touch with reality, there is historically a group of people that traditionally do not benefit from that, let's say, and that is the ultimate bearers of monotheism, the ultimate toehold of God's truth in this world, that is the Jewish people.
Now, I was, in preparation for this interview, I was rewatching your Turning Point debate with Dave Smith, and two things really struck me. One was Charlie Kirk's really almost heroic attempt to, even though obviously there were some things that Dave Smith said that I found very disagreeable, to have a civilized debate and to, you know, allow this discourse between two Americans on issues of critical of the day. But secondly, what also struck me was, you pointed out, right, I think correctly, Dave Smith's very, very harsh criticism of President Trump. But then right afterwards, he was getting standing ovations. And I think this is something similar with some of Tucker's criticism, others, Candace Owens' rant recently. It's also becoming in many ways sort of anti-Trump, whereas Trump was seen as the leader of the MAGA movement, the person who brought MAGA to the forefront. It seems like you're these new, I don't know, maybe it's a moral purity test, maybe it's this tendency to always move more and more to the extreme. But it seems like some of these people on the, and of course on the woke right or the isolationists, or you probably have a better term for it than I do, are starting to portray President Trump as the enemy and somebody who's in Netanyahu's pocket and somebody who can't be trusted and somebody who's acting against American interests. Do you think that's right?
Yes. I wrote an essay for Barry White's publication, The Free Press, in July. The title of this essay was Why Tucker Carlson is So Fixated on Jeffrey Epstein. I wrote this essay, probably just a few days, actually, maybe even less than a week, give or take, after I debated Smith at that Turning Point conference. And Tucker was actually really fixated on Jeffrey Epstein at that very Turning Point conference. In fact, in that particular speech, Tucker, on the one hand, said that Americans who served in the IDF should be stripped of American citizenship. And on the other hand, he just nakedly asserted without any compelling evidence to support it that Jeffrey Epstein was a Mossad asset. And it was around the same time that I noticed a very interesting article that kind of flew under the radar at a publication that unfortunately calls itself the American Conservative. It is neither conservative nor, I would argue, particularly American. It is actually increasingly an anti-American, anti-Western civilization vessel. And this publication published this article, I believe was titled MAGA versus Ultra MAGA or something about that. And the basic thesis is that MAGA has been corrupted by all the various forces that you'd expect. It's been corrupted by the Jews, the Zionists, the Christian Zionists, the globalists, I guess, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And therefore, the only solution is Ultra MAGA. Well, first of all, this is a total misreading of the history. Donald Trump has always been a very pro-Jewish, pro-Israel, among other things, statesman. I mean, his daughter is a literal convert to Judaism. He has Jewish grandchildren. He's the first president in American history to have a Jewish child and Jewish grandchildren. But hold that aside. The basic premise of this American conservative piece is that there is this divide, and that so-called Ultra MAGA, which is this whole conspiratorial wing that traffics in anti-Semitism, anti-Americanism, pro-Russia, Russophilia, pro-Iran, pro-Qatar, all this crap. This notion is that ultra-MAGA will have to then supplant MAGA. So I was looking at this, and then—
you make MAGA great again.
I guess. I mean, again, that's the reading of the history. I just think they're misreading the history of MAGA, but again, that's our disagreement, perhaps. But to me, that is what the Tucker wing is trying to do. They're not trying to kind of have an inclusive movement, right? They're not trying to kind of have a marketplace of ideas, kind of free for all conversation. That's what they would have you believe. That's actually not what they're interested in doing. They're trying to burn it all down. They're trying to destroy the current iteration of the American right, literally destroy it root and branch, and then build something new in its stead. Ask yourself this: would someone who was actively rooting for Donald Trump and J.D. Vance to win the 2024 election, would someone who's actively rooting for that have hosted Daryl Cooper on his show 2 months prior to that election, to literally host on his show someone who says that maybe America should have sided not with Stalin but with Hitler in World War II, that the Jews just ended up dead because the Nazis didn't really know what to do with all these displaced persons? This was after Tucker appeared sitting two or three seats down from Donald Trump on the first night of the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in July. So a month and a half later, he has this guy on his show. Is that a guy who seems like he really wants to win the 2024 election? I think there's a very real question there. So it seems to me like they're actually trying to do nothing less than to hijack the entire movement, but by which they mean trying to burn it down to the ashes and then rebuild it in their dystopian image.
And let's go to even crazier than the people we've been talking about, which is Candace Owens, who
are you suing her?
Well, maybe some of our listeners don't know exactly what happened. So if you just give us a little background on how she, it seemed like she may have surprised you. I think it was on Sukkot when she started attacking you. But you tell us how you experienced it.
Yeah, this is earlier this month on Erev Sukkot, as the case may be. So the holiday started on a Monday evening, if memory serves. It was literally like 20 minutes before I turned my phone off, like literally 20 minutes that I saw on social media. And here in the U.S., obviously, it's a 2-day Yom Tov. So, 20 minutes before I turned my phone off, like 49 hours, whatever, I started seeing on Twitter that Candace Owens had acquired screenshots of this private WhatsApp chat that I had been in with Charlie and a small handful of others, five or six others. By the way, Charlie Kirk personally started this WhatsApp chat because he was very concerned about growing anti-Semitism on the right. He called this chat Saving Civilization for the very simple reason that he viewed Jews and Christians, America and Israel, as the four pillars. These are his own words, as the four pillars of Western civilization. So, okay. So this chat somehow ends up finding its way to Candace Owens. We now know that Andrew Colvett, Charlie's executive producer, turned his new kind of fill-in host. I've known Andrew for many years. We're very friendly. Andrew has admitted to screenshotting these and allegedly the stories that was laundered through an intermediary to Candace. We're not going to solve that crap that case here on this show right now. Anyway, yes, Candace acquires these texts, and I go offline for Yom Tov. And yes, at some point over the next 24 to 36 hours, one or two people approach me at synagogue and are like, you're going to be interested in seeing what Candace Owens is saying about you when you turn your phone back on. And I turn my phone back on that Wednesday evening, U.S. time.
That must have been very difficult psychologically to know that there's this conversation about you going on online, and because of your observance of the Jewish holiday, you can't turn it on and find out what's going on.
Yes, but I'm personally pretty good at trying to kind of separate that. It's not easy, obviously, in a situation like that, but I take very seriously the notion. I mean, Sukkot, above all, is kind of the Jewish holiday most affiliated with Zimon Simchatena, with the time of our rejoicing, and I take that obligation very seriously, Leviticus chapter 23. I really do try to intuit that. So I did my best. It's not an easy thing to do in a situation like that, but I did my best. And then I turned my phone back on that Wednesday, and I was up to like 3 a.m. that night just going through all my voicemails and just the utter monstrosity of messages and then this and that there.
What was she claiming? This is for people who don't know.
Oh, yes. So for those who are not aware of the story, Candace Owens effectively implied that I murdered Charlie Kirk or had foreknowledge and played some role in the murder of my own friend Charlie Kirk. She did this by... it's not even clear exactly what her mental process entailed. She found a totally unrelated tweet that I tweeted out the day or two before Charlie's assassination, where I was talking about the horrific murder of the Ukrainian refugee Arina Zarutska on the light rail in Charlotte, North Carolina, and calling for a public execution for that murderer, something that I've been doing literally since law school, by the way. I happen to be a big proponent of public executions for the worst offenders. I've been doing this for over a decade now. And she then said that I was talking actually about previewing Charlie Kirk's assassination later that week. The whole thing is just ludicrous to the point of insanity. She took a couple of these screenshots of Charlie's out of context to imply that he was turning on Israel when in fact he was kind of just blowing off steam. He was frustrated losing a major pro-Israel Jewish donor. In fact, what Candace didn't say and what I subsequently then the day after I got back online had to show in a screenshot, I didn't want to do a screenshot, but I kind of had to defend my honor at some point. 2 to 3 hours after these screenshots that Candace claimed showed Charlie turning on Israel, we actually had a Zoom call. Me and Rabbi Pesach Wilicki, who lives in Jerusalem, and one or two others, had a Zoom call with Charlie at Charlie's request to prep him for his then upcoming campus tour about how to approach millennials and Gen Z on questions pertaining to Israel and the Jewish people. So he sought our counsel. And then in the WhatsApp chat, he was like, thank you guys so much for the call, like super helpful. He was genuinely grateful for our advice there. So Charlie Kirk was not turning on Israel. He was keenly aware, he was acutely aware of how Gen Z was not a particularly healthy place in some ways on this issue, and he was trying to figure out the best way forward, as many of us, frankly, are doing there. And he was kind of just workshopping a lot of ideas there, but he was not turning on you. Okay, anyway, Candace. So Candace then accuses me of murdering Charlie. I have a lot of crazy people that show up in my mentions, in my DMs, as you can imagine. To this day, I can't really post anything on Twitter without being called the Charlie Kirk murderer by a bunch of raging neo-Nazis. They actually ended up arresting someone, by the way. So I live in Florida. I was in touch with the Florida law enforcement. They ended up arresting someone outside Houston, Texas, for issuing online death threats against me and three other Floridians, actually, as the case may be. Carol Markowitz of the New York Post, Seth Dillon, the Babylon Bee, and Laura Loomer. That person now faces potentially up to 140 years behind bars, depending on how that trial ultimately works out. So that's currently where things stand. I did indeed speak with multiple attorneys about the possibility of filing a defamation lawsuit. I myself am also an attorney for what it's worth. I clerked in the federal appeals court. I know a thing or two about defamation law and the First Amendment here in the U.S. We have a totally viable case when it comes to defamation, I believe, on the merits. For reasons unrelated to the legal merits, I'm not going to pull the trigger at this exact time, but there is a 2-year statute of limitations on the defamation claim here in Florida, so we have plenty of time to still mold it over.
So Candace is, I mean, the Like Tucker, they're two of the most popular podcasters in the world. And it seems like, you know, you said that we don't really know where the numbers come from. It could be bots. It could be outside the United States. But it seems like they get like a disproportionate amount of the attention. And it seems like this was also something that Charlie himself was sort of grappling with before he was murdered. So what do you think needs to be done to get the message across, you know, the pro-Israel message, the fighting against anti-Semitism message? I mean, I'd rather it be a positive message about Jews than fighting something. But, you know, maybe the first step needs to be fighting, and then after that, I'll be positive. So what do you think needs to be done?
Well, I don't claim to have all the answers, but I can say a few things. One is that I know that the old playbook is simply not working. So the old playbook that worked for a period of time, let's call it the golden age of American Jewish life, kind of those, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, kind of those decades where the West was still kind of recovering from its post-World War II, post-Holocaust guilt. You know, this is kind of when the ADL was a more respectable, venerable organization, and the whole notion of kind of anti-Semitism training, that sort of stuff, really seemed to make a difference. But what I know is that in the year 2025, calling someone an anti-Semite is not only not effective, it is oftentimes actually counterproductive. Now, that can't necessarily always stop you, because it just happens to be true sometimes, right? I mean, I have actually publicly said that Tucker Carlson is the most dangerous anti-Semite in American history for the very simple reason that he is. So there's, on the one hand, you can't actually just stop calling a spade. On the other hand, certainly other tactics and ideas are very much, I think, called for at this moment. So one thing that I think Jews need to do a better job of understanding is that, and you know, Tucker, to his diabolical credit, kind of made this actually crystal clear, albeit he probably didn't intend to do this, but in his Fuentes interview, he made really clear that his real disgust is not just with Jews, it's with Christian Zionists. Tucker goes on this whole rant referring to Christian Zionists as heretical, as a distortion of Christianity. By the way, Tucker had a Christian pastor on his show in August where he shockingly confessed that he just read the Old Testament, aka the Hebrew Bible, for the first time last year. So, you know, if anyone is heretical on Christianity's own terms, it seems to me that it would probably be the guy who just read 75% of his own professed Bible literally last year, but neither here nor there. But if Tucker is really this disgusted by Christian Zionists, by which he means the Mike Huckabees and Ted Cruz's of the world, by which he also means probably a plurality of the Republican Party's voting base. I mean, maybe not an outright statistical majority, but definitely a plurality. Then he really has in his crosshairs a much larger percent of the American population than just the tiny sliver that are American Jews. He really hates a lot of Christians. He really hates a lot of evangelicals. He really hates a lot of sincere Christians, dare I say Christians who are a lot more sincere than he is, who interpret the scripture in a way that does not redound to Tucker Carlson's liking there. So I think that we have to kind of frame this more broadly. It's not just a war on the Jews, which it definitely is to an extent. It's also a war on evangelical proselytism. It's a war on the Bible. It's a war on the ecumenical biblical inheritance that birthed Western civilization. This is exactly why I wrote my book earlier this year, Israel and Civilization, which is literally this. It is a framing of Western civilization as an outgrowth of the ecumenical, biblical, Judeo-Christian inheritance there, and while we have to stand shoulder to shoulder to ward it off there. So these are the things that I would encourage folks to kind of gravitate towards. Charlie, to his great credit, was a Hebrew Bible-centric Christian, very much in the mode of the American founders. He was a genuine philo-Semite. He literally kept his version of Shabbat. He would turn his phone off on Friday nights to Saturday night. He's a whole forthcoming book, a posthumous book to be released in December on the beauty of the Sabbath called Stop in the Name of God. So there's just there's a lot there that he was doing amazing that we had to kind of pick up the torch and make sure that I think a lot of our Christian friends understand that this battle is being waged, this information operation by the Tuckers and Cannons of the world. It is really not just about the Jews. The Jews, as has always been the case, are really just the canaries in the coal mine. But the broader goal here is the rupturing of the Jewish-Christian alliance, and then therefore ultimately the rupturing of the biblical inheritance, and frankly, really a war on nothing less than Western civilization itself.
And as you mentioned also, it seems to be a rupture or a debate within Christianity, and I'm no expert on Christianity, but when Tucker is, you know, being disgusted by the fact that Christians can be Zionists, but as you pointed out, Mike Huckabee and tens of millions of Americans would see themselves as Christian Zionists, it's a debate about what is authentic Christianity as well. And then it probably has much deeper roots, but it's coming again to the forefront, especially as, I think with the election of, you know, one of the things that struck me after Charlie Kirk was murdered in cold blood, and we were all, you know, crestfallen, and was the discourse when he was shot was, you know, everybody pray, and then at the funeral, how religious the discourse was, both as people were waiting to find out what was going to happen to him, and then after it was announced that he was murdered. So with this return of a religious discourse to the American general discourse, we seem to have this debate within Christianity also that is coming to the forefront.
Yes, I think that's right. So there was a generation of Christian conservative leaders. I'm thinking here of kind of the Jerry Falwell moral majority back in the 1970s, 1980s, Pat Robertson. You know, even Pastor Hagee of CUFI, of Christians United for Israel, is kind of very much of this vanguard. And there was really this whole generation of evangelicals who were really big on this book of Genesis, I would say, book of Genesis-centric approach to Jewish-Christian relations, very heavy on Genesis 12, verse 3, Parsha Lech Lecha, this notion that God will bless those who bless the children of Abraham and curse those who curse them. And Charlie himself was kind of a throwback in this respect. Charlie himself had a photo that he posted to social media a few years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, and I don't remember the exact year, where he was actually at the Kotel, at the Western Wall, and he puts over this image, Genesis 12, 3. And, you know, for various reasons that are somewhat not worth getting into and also somewhat kind of beyond my personal comprehension, I just know from talking to a lot of Christian friends that this argument is on the descendant among younger, even conservative Christians, younger evangelical Christians there. A lot of folks just aren't necessarily buying this form of a particular Christian theology. Now, that does not mean that they're necessarily turning on Israel or the Jews. It just means that other arguments have to be made there. So, you know, I'm not super big on kind of making a lot of these Genesis-centric arguments there. I emphasize more generally just the broader ecumenical biblical inheritance. I try to pinpoint specific parts of the Torah and the Tanakh that have deeply, directly imbued day-to-day American life, day-to-day Western life, everything from the Golden Rule itself, Leviticus 19:18, to structures of government. I mean, this notion that the king is not above the law, and therefore the president of the United States is not above the law, is literally from Deuteronomy chapter 17. So, you know, that's kind of one of the things that I do is talk a lot about that and try to emphasize that as well. And I think a lot of younger Christian conservatives, just like a lot of conservatives here in general, in kind of this post-Bush, post-Trump era, really gravitate towards just good old-fashioned, you know, concrete nationalist, realist arguments, which is something that I'd like to do a lot as well. I have a whole chapter in my book, actually, making the explicitly realist America First, let's call it the MAGA case for U.S.-Israel relations, which is really not a very difficult chapter to write, by the way, because it's literally Donald Trump's foreign policy, or at least it was during the first term. The second term is a little more complicated, maybe, but it definitely was his foreign policy during the first term there. So these are all the kind of things that I think about a lot, and I would encourage others to think about as well.
I want to ask you about something you just said, where you said it was easy to make the case about Trump's first term, that it was, you know, the MAGA America First case for relations in Israel, and that now it's harder. Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, look, I think the second term approach to the Middle East has been generally good. I certainly generally like what I see. I thought Donald Trump's speech to the Knesset was wonderful. I mean, I think that Donald Trump is instinctually in his core a genuine friend of the Jewish people and the state of Israel. He really is. And this is as simple as the fact that, one, he's a born and raised New Yorker, but he's been surrounded by a lot of prominent Jews in the real estate industry and so forth. Literally his entire life, he has a genuine kind of cultural affinity towards Jewish people. And on the other hand, he's something of a meritocrat, and he values that I think American Jews have done very well. That's part of the reason why he's been so chummy with them over the years. And then finally, as I said earlier, he literally has a Jewish daughter and Jewish grandchildren. So I think that he has a genuine affinity for the Jewish people and for the state of Israel. He's also a largely business deal, in some ways, transactional-centric president there. And that has not stopped him, perhaps most of the point, of getting far too close, I would argue, to Qatar. I do not like how close this administration is to Qatar. I do not like the fact that Qatar wants to sell us a new Air Force One. I do not like the fact that President Trump took over $1 trillion in pledged investment from the Emir of Qatar. I do not like the fact that in the Oval Office, apparently, they made Netanyahu issue a groveling apology to the Emir, apologizing for the largely, actually, in hindsight, failed strike of the Hamasniks there outside Doha, Qatar. I don't like any of this. So I don't like the fact that Qatar is seemingly so powerful within this administration. We can kind of debate why that is the case. It seems to me like Steve Witkoff, among others, is just generally far too cozy with the Qataris there. Look, at the moment that you and I are speaking, I think there are still some unanswered questions as well, right? I mean, this hostage deal, it's amazing, obviously, just to see the hostages release. But Hamas is still violating the terms as of right now. What's going to happen? I mean, how long is Israel going to wait before it issues some sort of retaliatory response? And perhaps more to the point, if/when that happens, what is President Trump going to say and what is he going to do? I don't really know the answer here, but what I can tell you is that there are two competing impulses here, and this is probably what we're seeing play out with some of these intra-administration tensions. The two impulses are, on the one hand, Trump is indeed a genuine instinctual philo-Semite and a friend of Israel. On the other hand, he's also an instinctual peacemaker. He just loves peace, right? He's made these peace deals in Thailand, Cambodia, in India, Pakistan, Rwanda, Congo, Armenia, Azerbaijan, a huge one that kind of flew under the radar here in the U.S. there. So he really, really, really wants there to be some sort of peace there. Obviously, the elephant in the room is that you're dealing with these radical 7th century aspiring Sharia supremacist jihadists who have no interest whatsoever in peace there. And that's ultimately where the rubber hits the road.
I want to ask you, you were a friend of Charlie Kirk, and well, since with Charlie Kirk was a well-known public figure, and all the videos of him debating people who are attacking Israel, attacking all different elements of Western civilization, his responses. But can you tell something about Charlie Kirk that maybe most people who only knew his public image didn't know about him?
Sure. Charlie was a very loyal person. For him, loyalty was about the most important trait that you could have. So when you showed Charlie that you were loyal to him in a personal sense, if he was kind of being criticized and you would come to defend him, he would really go above and beyond for you. And there are a number of ways, especially over the final year or two of his life, as we became closer really towards the final end of his tragically truncated life, there were numerous ways that he really did kind of go above and beyond for me. To kind of give just one of many examples here, you know, my show, The Josh Hammer Show, which is a Newsweek production, it's Newsweek's intellectual property. We just signed a distribution agreement with Salem Media Group, the major American conservative, you know, radio, podcast, TV distributor. Charlie's own show, The Charlie Kirk Show, is a Salem property. And Charlie, you know, definitely, I mean, to be clear, I don't think it was Charlie's necessarily his doing that we ended up partnering with Salem. There are other factors at play, but Charlie definitely, you know, put in good words, help that process expedite there. You know, any number of other things as well. But he really was just a genuinely loyal person who really respected people that had his back, and he would have your back as well.
We talked a little bit about your book, or you mentioned your book a little bit, but I want to give you a chance to tell our listeners what it's about, what inspired you to write it. It's called Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West. So tell us about it.
For sure, yeah. So the book came out earlier this year in March. It's done, frankly, I think better than any of us expected. It actually reached a high of literally the number 3 book on all of Amazon.com, like the entire website. It had that for about 36 Yeah, I'd had that for about 36 to 48 hours right the day before the book came out, and then on release day itself. We actually sold out on Amazon literally on publication day, which is both a blessing and a curse. For those of you who have published books, you kind of probably know that feeling there. But the book is, it's essentially, as I mentioned earlier, it argues that Western civilization itself is the outgrowth of the Bible, and that Western civilization therefore begins in earnest when God's word was revealed in earnest for the first time to Moses and the Israelites standing there at the base of Mount Sinai. And that all that we take for granted today when it comes to our day-to-day moral, ethical norms, to our legal and political structure, all of that is ultimately downstream of the Bible. And the two great inheritors of the Bible today are the original people of the book, the Jewish people, and what a 20th century pope famously referred to as the great Gentile offshoot that really built Western civilization, Christians. So the book, especially in today's moment, given this sprawling information operation that is trying to divide Jews and Christians, trying to divide America and Israel, tries to kind of bring Humpty Dumpty back together again and say that, no, we actually do have a heck of a lot more in common than whatever it is that we may disagree upon. Jews and Christians, U.S. Israel, we're all shoulder to shoulder here. And ultimately, it is only this united front of this ecumenical biblical inheritance that can possibly withstand the three-headed monster of Western civilizational anti-subjugationist forces that seek to destroy us, which are, in my estimation, in no particular order, wokeism, Islamism, and global neoliberalism. That's kind of the three-headed hydra, as I see it there, and only a strong ecumenical Jewish-Christian biblical alliance can possibly be durable enough to withstand that threat. Now, the book also gets into contemporary foreign policy. There's a whole case on making kind of the nationalist case for Zionism. There's a whole chapter on the MAGA case for U.S.-Israel relations. There's actually a whole chapter, frankly, on my own personal Baal Teshuva story, trying to kind of inspire, you know, other less observant Jews to kind of, you know, wrap to fill in the morning, kind of just do a lot of that as well there. But I would say above all, this is really written for a predominantly younger millennial Gen Z audience, and really trying to appeal above all, even more so than my fellow Jews, to Christians to be tempted off of the Tucker Candace path. There is a healthier path. There is a more time-tested path. And that path is a path for a Christianity that is rooted not merely in the New Testament, but very much also in the Hebrew Bible, that is the shared inheritance of Jews and Christians alike.
Well, it's very, very powerfully put.
Thank you.
Josh Hammer, thank you so much for coming on the Misgav Mideast Horizons podcast.
Josh, people who want to follow you online, what's the best place to find out more about your book, about your work?
Sure. So my show, The Josh Hammer Show, is over on Newsweek's YouTube page and also at Salem News Channel and everywhere else you get podcasts, Apple, Spotify, etc. My syndicated weekly column goes up at Newsweek, Los Angeles Times, Real Clear Politics, a bunch of other places as well. I'm on X, Josh_Hammer, and I'm on Instagram at Josh B. Hammer. And then again, the book is Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West.
Fantastic. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to follow Misgav on social media and follow us on www.misgavins.org. You can send your comments, questions, and suggestions to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. And make sure to subscribe to the podcast. We will be here next week.